The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
You have an excellent commentary in your program about Mr. Books, including his identification with Radnor High School. What the program doesn't tell you is that he went to the University of Chicago and from there became a reporter with the City News Bureau covering local crime. But while he was at the University of Chicago, among other things, he wrote a humor column. And William F. Buckley was coming to the University of Chicago to give a talk, and David Brooks found him an appropriate subject for, if not ridicule, certainly a subject of humor, and he wrote a column that I think if you ever read it, you would find it quite humorous. And to Mr. Buckley's credit, when he came to the University of Chicago, in his comments to the audience, he said, and if David Buckley is here, I enjoyed his column, and I would like to offer him a job. So a couple of years after graduation, after he had done his early reporting in Chicago, David, in fact, called Mr. Buckley and said, is the offer still open? And it was, and so he went to New York and obviously from there to the Wall Street Journal and on to the greater fame and which he has so justly earned. So with that background, it is, again, my privilege to introduce David Brooks. I would ask you to be extra enthusiastic in terms of your applause because he's quoted in one of the articles that preceded the introduction of the book tour that he was concerned that he might be lonely on a book tour. And so we're just thrilled to have him here. And David Brooks, your audience awaits.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Another night without suicide. I appreciate that. It's a great pleasure to be here, more or less in my hometown. Went to Radnor High School about 13 miles west of here. And so it's always good to be back home in this area. And because I know Philadelphians, I know you didn't come to hear me speak. You came here to hear yourself speak. I'll try to be brief. Get out of your way. It is a pleasure to be back. I try to think of what my high school teachers at Radnor would have thought if they could see me addressing crowds in Philadelphia. There'd be widespread shock. And I was not a big man on campus at Radnor, though I was stuffed into lockers by some of the big men on campus. Actually, one of my debate partners, I was on the debate team, needless to say, one of my debate partners was a guy named Tom Wilson, who played Biff in the Back to the Future movies. And another one was a guy named Josh Werman, who chases tornadoes and was one of the subjects of the movie Twister years ago. So they went on to lead exciting lives, and I went on to talk. And now a lot of the people I talk with now are politicians. And so when I was given my current job at the Times, I was given a good piece of advice, which was to interview three politicians every day. And from spending that much time around them, I can tell you they're all emotional freaks of one sort or another. They have what I call logorrhea dementia, which is they talk so much they drive themselves insane. But they do have incredible social skills. When you meet them, by and large, they will stand real close to you. They'll invade your personal space. They'll rub the back of your head and caress your cheek. Dinner with a Republican senator a couple years ago, he kept his hand on my thigh the whole meal, sort of pushing for emphasis. Several years ago, I was up in the Senate Press Gallery, and I'm watching Dan Quayle and Ted Kennedy greet each other in the well of the Senate, and they give each other these big hugs, and their faces are like so far apart, and they're laughing and groping, and their hands are rubbing up and down each other's backs, and they're sort of grinding away there, and I'm like, get a room. I don't want to see this. another story I tell, which is a bit of name dropping, but you'll forgive me. I call it reporting. I'm going through a hotel in Boston a couple years ago, and Bill Clinton comes out of one of the elevators, and he starts praising me for a column I'd written praising him, which he thought was particularly astute column. But as he's talking, people see Bill Clinton in the lobby, and he starts backing up. And so he can, so they can all hear what he's saying. So within a few minutes, he's like 80 feet away, but he's just talking to me, but just embracing the crowd. Another case, I was following Mitt Romney around while he was campaigning in the last election cycle, and he was campaigning up in New Hampshire with his five perfect sons, Bip, Chip, Rip, Tip, Lip, and Bip. And so he goes into a diner, and he starts going around to the tables of the diner and introducing himself to the families and asking what village in New Hampshire they're from and describing the home he owned in their village. And then he would go around from table to table, and he meets like 30 people. And then on the way out, he first names almost everybody he's just met. I was like, okay, that's a profession I won't be going into. And then finally, I was just a few weeks ago at the National Institutes of Health, and I was shown by a neuroscientist a video of a young girl with Williams syndrome. And for those of you who don't know, Williams syndrome looks from the outside like reverse autism. And so the little girl's 18 months old, and she's in a room with a 12-year-old boy, the son of the researcher, and she only wants to look into his eyes. And she's the boy is juggling and knocking over stuff. She has no interest in the physical objects in the room. She only wants that social connection. So she gets close to him and just stares right into his eyes minute after minute. And I was watching the video thinking, this is every senator I've ever interviewed. And so they're socially attuned creatures. The odd thing is that when they turn their minds to policy, all that social sophistication vanishes, and they start thinking like CBO reports, like computer models. And I've covered a series of failures in my life, a lot of which have to do with the overly simplistic view of human nature. So I covered the decline of the Soviet Union, and we sent economists in there with privatization plans, but what they really lacked there was social trust. And we were blind to that. And as a result, they really stole everything in the country because they had no social trust. Then I covered the war in Iraq. We sent the military in, and our leaders were oblivious to the cultural and psychological realities in Iraq and unprepared for that. We had a financial system and a regulatory regime based on the assumption that bankers were rational, self-interested creatures who wouldn't do anything stupid en masse. And that turned out not to be true. Most importantly, for 30 years, I've covered education, trying to understand why 30% or 20% of kids drop out of high school. And we've tried for 30 years to try to raise high school graduation rates, and most of those efforts have been disappointing because we rearranged the bureaucratic boxes, big schools, little schools, charters, vouchers, while skirting the central issue, which is the individual relationship between a teacher and a student. And that people learn from people they love, and but if you talk about love at a congressional hearing, they look at you like you're Oprah. They just don't talk in that language. And so the question is, why do the most socially attuned people on Earth, why are they completely dehumanized when they think about policy? And I came to the conclusion that this was not simply a political problem, but a broader cultural problem. We have in our society this inherited view that we're divided selves, that we have reason over here and emotion over here. And the two are at war with one another. They're like on a seesaw. If you're emotional, then you're not rational. If you're rational, then you're not emotional. And that society progresses to the extent that reason, which is trustworthy, can suppress the passions, which are untrustworthy. And so this bias has led to a view of human nature that we are fundamentally rational individuals who respond in straightforward ways to incentives. It's led to a lot of our academic disciplines that try to study human behavior using the methods of physics, emphasizing what they can count and model, and sort of ignoring all the rest. And I think it's led to an amputation, a shallow view of human nature, where we emphasize things that are rational and countable, but ignore or are inarticulate about the things down below. And so it's created a culture in which we're really good at talking about material things, but bad at talking about emotions, really good at talking about health and safety and professional skills, but about the most important things like character and integrity, we often have very little to say. Alistair MacIntyre, the great philosopher, said, we live in a system where we still have the words for the important things like virtue and honor and vice, but we don't have a basic understanding of how they all fit together. He said, imagine we had some science words like neutron or gravity, but we didn't really understand how physics works, so how they all fit together. That's where we are. And so I do think we have this amputation which blows us in a certain way. And it blows us in the direction, this sort of prevailing breeze that we're not always satisfied with. I mentioned I went to high school, and my folks still live in Wayne, Pennsylvania, out in just west of here. And you see the parents there and in many places around the country sort of trapped into a certain style of raising their kids. And so you go to an elementary school out there, and the kids, the third graders come out, they're wearing these 80-pound backpacks. If the wind blows them over, they're like beetles sort of stuck there on the ground. Because we want them to study and do homework and get ready for the Harvard admissions test. They get picked up by Saabs and Audis and Volvos, because in that town it's socially acceptable to have a luxury car so long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy. And they get raised and picked up by this creature I wrote about in an earlier book called Uber Moms, who are highly successful queer women who have taken time off to make sure all their kids get into Harvard, and they actually weigh less than their own children. And sort of they're doing little butt exercises during the moment of conception, in the delivery room, cutting the umbilical cord themselves. The baby sort of plops out there and they're flashing the Mandarin flashcards at the thing to get it so it can learn Chinese. And so they turn them into little achievement machines, and SAT prep, oboe practice, and they're not really happy with it. They don't think this is the most important thing, but the tiger mom down the street is doing it, and they feel sort of trapped into a system which they ridicule, but they actually can't renounce. And they're often in a system where they sort of intuit that morality and character matters most, but they don't quite have a vocabulary for it. And so when people talk about morality, often we end up talking about shopping. And so, you know, we're out in Radnor, we have the Ben & Jerry's ice cream, the ice cream company with its own foreign policy. I joked in one of my books about out there that Ben & Jerry should make a pacifist toothpaste, doesn't kill germs, just ask them to leave. It'd be a big seller. We've got a Whole Foods Market, one of the enlightened grocery stores where all the cashiers look like they're on loan from Amnesty International. In my household, we buy their seaweed-based snacks. We call it veggie booty with kale for kids who come home and say, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colon rectal cancer. I think this is sort of the world we're sort of trapped in. But we realize that that's actually not all there is. And there's more to life, and it's more that we should be experiencing. And so I was thinking about this problem, and gradually I became aware of this other sphere of life where they were looking into some of the deeper things. And oddly, it wasn't theologians, though I read a lot of theologians, it wasn't really philosophers, but it was people who study the human mind. We're in this incredibly exciting period in the study of the mind, and it's being done across a wider range of spheres like neuroscience, cognitive science, psychology, behavioral economics, all these spheres. People are looking into the human mind. And really, it's a revolution in consciousness, if you want to put it that way, because when you synthesize their findings across these many different spheres, you really start with three key insights. And the first insight is that while the conscious mind writes the autobiography of our species, most of the action and most of the most impressive action is happening unconsciously below the level of awareness. And one way to think about this is that the human mind can take in roughly 12 million pieces of information a minute, of which it can consciously process about 40. And all the rest is being done really without our being aware of it. And a lot of the things that are going on are somewhat odd, and my favorite research finding from a University of Buffalo scholar is that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. People named Lawrence are disproportionately likely to become lawyers, because unconsciously we gravitate toward things that are familiar, which is why I've named my daughter to the President of the United States, Brooks. I think that'll... And then some of the things that are going on unconsciously are sort of impressive. It's not the tangled web of sexual urges that Freud imagined. Some of it, the unconscious is really just a different way of understanding the world and often yielding superior results. So one of the tips I read about was that if you have a tough decision, you can't make up your mind, tell yourself you'll decide it by a coin flip. and then flip the coin, but don't go by how the coin comes up. Go by your emotional reaction to the coin flip. Are you happy or sad it came up that way? And that's your unconscious mind having made the decision and telling you what it thinks. And then the third area that happens unconsciously is really the most important. How do we relate to people? How do we understand situations? How do we perceive the world? These are really the fundamental factors in whether we're going to have a successful or unsuccessful life, fulfilling or unfulfilling life. And a lot of that action is happening unconsciously. The second insight is that emotions aren't the enemy of thinking. Emotions are at the center of thinking. People who have strokes and lesions and can't process emotion properly are not super smart. They're super dumb. Because what the emotions do is they assign value to things. They tell you what you want, what you value, what you don't value. And if you don't have that valuation device, you cannot make rational decisions. And so emotions are not separate from reason. They are the foundation of reason. Now, I'm a middle-aged guy. I'm not comfortable talking about emotion, particularly. One of the scientific experiments I ran into, which I think is apocryphal, but I still think it gets at a truth, which is they took a bunch of middle-aged guys, they put them in fMRI, these brain scan machines, and they had them watch a horror movie, and then they had them describe their feelings toward their wives. And the brain scans were the same in both circumstances. So it just sheer terror. And I know what that's like. My wife says that me writing a book about emotion is like Gandhi writing a book about gluttony. It's not a natural thing. And yet, emotions really are the center of how we perceive the world, how we value the world. They are the center of how our brain organizes itself. In 1945, there was an orphanage out west that was studied by a psychologist named Renee Spitz. And at this orphanage, they decided to keep the kids healthy, they would keep them germ-free. So they gave them food and good health care, but they did not handle them, and they separated them. And those kids died by age 2. They had a 37% mortality rate. And they stopped naming the kids because they just weren't living long enough. And so that's a sign of how emotion is literally physically necessary. And so emotion is something you just have to get comfortable with. And the third insight is that we're not primarily self-contained individuals. We're social animals with deep interpenetrations to another. At every second, our mind is not only seeing you and you're not only seeing me, we are reenacting what we see in each other inside our own mind. We're deeply interpenetrated. And there are all sorts of communication methods through which we are communicating in ways we're not even aware. And so there was one story about a psychology professor who wandered up and down the stage from side to side, and his class played a trick on him where they said, when he's over here, we'll look at him. When he's over there, we won't. And within 2 minutes, he was sort of out the door over here. He just felt better over there. Another experiment done in Germany, they took gauze pads, taped it under people's arms, had some people watch a horror movie, some people watch a comedy. They got other people to sniff the gauze pads, presumably well paid, and say, did the gauze pad wearer watch a comedy or a horror movie? And people could tell it way above average than chance who saw what. Women, by the way, were much better at this than men. And so we are deeply interpenetrated. And so these findings really give us a different story of how life works and a different story of who we are. And so we're in many ways children of the French Enlightenment, of Descartes, believing that reason is the highest of our faculties. But this research really confirms some of the emphasis of the British or Scottish Enlightenment, David Hume and Adam Smith and Edmund Burke, that reason is weak and what they called our sentiments are quite strong, our most important faculty. And it gives us a different view of who we are and I think a different view of human capital, of what it takes to lead a fulfilling life. When we talk about human capital, we often talk about the things we can measure. Grades, degrees, SAT scores, IQs, all that's important. But there are other qualities which I think are more important, which are both emotional and rational, and make a hash of these two categories. And so one of these talents, I would say, is this thing called mindsight, the ability to enter other minds and learn and download what those minds have to teach you. Babies come equipped to this to a great degree. So Alan Meltzoff was a researcher at the University of Washington, leaned over a baby who was 43 minutes old, wagged his tongue at the baby, and she wagged her tongue back. That's because babies, even at this phenomenally early age, are built to merge with the minds they come into contact with and really absorb models for understanding the world from who they come in contact with. Now, by 18 months, about 55% of American babies have established a two-way relationship with mom, primarily, but also with dad. And those kids have what they call secure attachments. They really know how to build relationships with parents and with adults. And those kids have a huge leg up. And so researchers can take a look at kids who are 18 months old, look at how they attach to mom, and predict with 77% accuracy who's going to graduate from high school. Because if you can go into a school, even at 3 or 2 or 5, and you know how to relate to teacher, you just have a better shot of doing well in school. About 20% of the kids are what they call avoidantly attached. And these are kids who have been sending out signals, but not much has been coming back at them. And so a teacher described one of the avoidantly attached kids coming in the classroom, tacking like a sailboat into the wind, wanting to get close to teacher, but not knowing how to do it. And those avoidantly attached kids have less activation in the reward areas of their brains during social interaction. They get less of a kick out of social engagement. By age 70, they'll have many, many fewer friends than others. And now something that happens at 18 months does not determine a life course, but it opens up a pathway which can be either confirmed or disconfirmed by later experience. Somebody with a bad attachment can then discover a mentor and it can all be changed. Their lives can be changed. But these are some of the skills you learn very early on. A second skill I would list is what you might call equipoise. This is the serenity and maturity to look inside your own mind and be aware of your own weaknesses. So, for example, the unconscious have many skills, but it has some weaknesses. We are overconfidence machines. 95% of college professors believe they have above-average teaching skills. 96% of college students have above-average leadership skills. Time magazine asked people, are you in the top 1% of earners? 19% of Americans are in the top 1% of earners. Paul Shoemaker and Edward Russo gave tests to executives about their own industry and asked them, how confident are you you got your answers right? So advertising executives said they were confident they get 90% of the answers right. In fact, they got 60% of them wrong. Computer executives, the most overconfident industry, thought they got 95% of the answers right. In fact, they got 80% wrong. This is a strongly gender-linked trait. So men drown at twice the rate as women because men think they can swim across that lake, especially after they've been drinking. And so have the ability to correct for your own biases. You have the ability to be open-minded in the face of ambiguity, to adjust the strength of your conclusion to the strength of your evidence, to be modest in the face of the things you don't know, to invent modesty devices for yourself. Peter Drucker had a great one. He said, when you make a decision, write down your reasoning, seal it in an envelope, and open it in 9 months. You'll discover a third of your decisions were right, a third were wrong, a third were in between, but in most cases, your reasoning will be completely irrelevant. And so these are all skills that are only tangentially related to IQ, mental character, not mental force, but it has to do with your emotional equilibrium. The third trait is a Greek word called metis, which we might call street smarts, the ability to look across a complicated scene and pick out a pattern, derive a gist. There was a great story in my newspaper about soldiers in Iraq who could look down a street and sort of tell if there was a bomb buried on that street. And they couldn't exactly tell you why. They just felt a coldness inside. Some people have this sensitivity to the landscape. And that's a skill that comes from practice, from close observation and practice. And that most of that perception is unconscious. The fourth thing you might call sympathy, which is sensitivity to an emotional and social environment. Can you pick out what other people are feeling and sensing? And this comes in extremely handy working in groups. Most of us work in groups because groups function more effectively than individuals. You give a group a card test and individuals, the groups will solve it much better. And the capacity of a group to solve the card tricks or math problems or anything else they're given is not related to the high IQ or the median IQ in the group. It's related to how well do those people read each other's emotional signals. How often do they take turns while communicating? That's how well a group does. And face-to-face groups do a lot better than groups that communicate electronically, by the way. So at the University of Michigan, they gave some people math problems, gave one set of groups 10 minutes to solve the problems face-to-face, and they did very well solving the problems. Gave another set of groups 30 minutes to solve them, but they had to communicate by email, and those groups could not solve the problems. And so beware teleconferencing. face-to-face is just a lot better. And some people have the ability to read those things and some don't. The fifth trait I would list is called propriety, the ability to set up scaffolds to control some of your impulses. The most famous experiment in this whole field, which many of you probably know, is called the marshmallow experiment done by a guy named Walter Mischel. And just very quickly, Mischel took four-year-olds, put them in a room, put marshmallows in table in front of them, said, you can eat this marshmallow now. I'm going to leave the room, come back in 10 minutes. And if you haven't eaten the marshmallow, I'll give you two marshmallows. And so he showed me videos of the kids trying not to eat the marshmallow. There's a little girl banging her head on the table trying not to eat the marshmallow. One day, Mischel was using an Oreo cookie. The little guy picks up the Oreo, carefully eats out the middle, carefully puts it back. That kid is now a U.S. senator. But the scary thing is the kids who could wait 10 minutes 20 years later had much higher college completion rates. 30 years later, much higher incomes. The kids who could only wait 1 minute, much higher drug and alcohol addiction problems 20 years later, much higher incarceration rates going to jail 30 years later. And that's because some kids grow up in homes where actions lead to consequences and they develop strategies to control their impulses, mostly by pretending the marshmallow is a cloud or that it's not real, somehow pretending that that temptation is not really there in front of them. And so the kids who can go to school with that self-control will find school a lot less frustrating than kids who cannot. And these are other traits that are really baked in early or encouraged early and really happen unconsciously for the most part. Now, the final trait I'll mention is not so much a trait. It's more of a motivation, and I call it limerence. The conscious mind hungers for money, for success, for fame, for recognition. But what the unconscious mind hungers for the most, I think, is those moments when the self fades away, and the skull line fades away, and we find ourselves lost in a challenge or a task or another. And it's those moments of transcendence when a craftsman is lost in, say, carpentry, when a naturalist feels at one with nature, when a believer feels subsumed by God's love, or most frequently for most of us, when we find it in love for one another, and we lose the sense of ourself because of love for one another. Now, this decision to fall in love, like so many decisions, is both rational and emotional at the same time and makes a hash of those categories. So when we see somebody we might potentially fall in love with, one of the things we're doing unconsciously is measuring that person in all sorts of ways. We tend to marry people who have nose-widths similar to our own. We tend to marry people with eye-widths similar to our own. We tend to marry people with complementary immune systems, which we can tell by smell. We tend to marry people who have the maximum status symbols that we can get. And so women, unfortunately, tend to marry or tend to admire men who are taller than they are because the average inch in height in America equals about $6,000 a year in annual salary. But one study I came across suggested that a guy who's 5'6" can get as many online date offers on an online site as a guy who's 6 foot, so long as he makes $172,000 a year more. And so some of this is sort of rational and cold and calculating, even though it's being done unconsciously. But some of it is quite deep and mystical. And you would say enchanted. Stendhal had a great phrase called crystallization. And he described these salt miners in Austria who would take branches and throw it into a salt mine. They'd come back a few weeks later and hold them up to the sun, and the branches would be covered with these crystals, and they would glimmer in the sun. And he said, that's what we do to our beloved. We imagine they have all these crystals around them, and we sort of exaggerate their virtues. And we become sort of addicted to them. And the brain scientists say that love inside the brain looks very much like a cocaine addiction. It's not an emotion so much as a state of need, a desire to become completely fused one with another. And I tell high school students, though they don't believe me, that every course they should take in college should help them decide who to marry. That is the only important decision they're probably going to make in their lives. A good marriage produces the same happiness gain as making $100,000 a year more. If you have a good marriage and a bad career, you'll be happy. If you have a bad marriage and a good career, you'll be unhappy. So every course should help you make that decision. None of them believe me. None of them do it. But in those courses and in that desire to fuse with one another, we get this sense of essentially who we are, that we're divided by skull, we're divided by consciousness, but deep down we deeply want to interpenetrate one to another, and that is the highest thing we long for. And one of the beautiful examples I found of that was I found in a book by a guy named Douglas Hofstetter, who's an Indiana University scientist who researches the mind. And Hofstetter was married to a woman named Carol, and he went out on sabbatical. They lived in Italy, when their kids were 5 and 2, Carol suddenly suffered a stroke and died very suddenly. And when Carol was dead, but Hofstetter was still living over there, one day, a few months later, he was walking through his bedroom, and he happened to have a picture of Carol on the bureau in his bedroom. And just, you know, as he'd done many days in a row, he just happened to glance at her face as he was walking through. And here's what he wrote in his book, I Am a Strange Loop, about that experience. I looked at her face, and I looked so deeply that I felt I was behind her eyes. And all at once, I found myself saying, as tears flowed, that's me, that's me. And those simple words brought back many thoughts that I had had before about the fusion of our souls into one higher level entity, about the fact that at the core of both our souls, they are identical hopes and dreams for our children, about the notion that those hopes were not separate or distinct hopes, but were just one hope, one clear thing that defined us both, that welded us into a unit, the kind of unit I had but dimly imagined before being married and having children. I realized that though Carol had died, that core piece of her had not died at all, but that it had lived on very determinedly in my brain. Now, the Greeks used to say we suffer our way to wisdom, and Hofstetter suffered his way to the wisdom, which he confirmed as a scientist every day, that there are shared loops that permeate our minds in ways that are much deeper than we're aware of. And in a shallower and less important way, I think the policy failures that we've seen, the educational reform failures, Soviet Union, financial reform, we've suffered our way to the wisdom that the shallow view of human nature that has become dominant in our society is an insufficient view. And that it's important if we're going to design good policies, lead good lives, to have a much richer sense of who we are. And the good news is that we're in this incredible period where researchers from all these fields are really giving us a deeper view. And I think their influence is going to pervade society year upon year, decade upon decade, and really give us a much richer sense and really remind us of a new humanism, not giving us a new view of human nature, but reminding us some of the old philosophies, the old truths, and the old depths that are there. And it's for me, it's been just tremendously exciting to be around those people for the past few years and to look forward to all the things they're going to bring to our culture in the years ahead. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, David. So my name's Andy. I'm the director of author events here. I think, Hal, most of you know how this works. Put your hand up. Please wait for the mic. We'll get it to you. And David said all questions are game, so we don't have to limit it to the book. Who would like to start us off? Dead center, gentleman with the tie.
Two quick questions. Your comments about children and... many women work today, so when the child is 6 weeks or 3 months old, they go to daycare. How does that affect them? And the second thing in schools, teachers, especially with elementary and nursery school, can't touch kids. And you made a comment about how emotionally tied these children should be to teachers, right. And yet they're not allowed to touch them.
Yeah. First on the daycare, the good part about this research is that you don't have to be super parent to be good enough. That if you establish good relationships with kids, if you listen to them, if you attune to their needs, if when they're nervous you sort of try to calm them down, when they're down you try to bring them up, if you're sort of aware of who they are in just a very basic way, that is the threshold you need to cross. You don't need to be super mom or dad. In fact, most of the super mom or dad stuff doesn't do any good. And so you just have to be good enough. And so that's sort of relaxing, I think, for most parents when you look at this research. There's a guy named Eric Turkheimer who's written quite a lot about this phenomenon at the University of Virginia. And so most parents, whether they work or not, who are listening or attuned, have good relationships, they've done what they need to do, at least on that front. Now, as for daycare, the the evidence is sort of mixed, and I guess it's mixed because the results are not that firm either way. It has an effect on kids. If kids who spend, well, the first thing to be said is there's daycare and there's daycare. Some are very good and some are not so good. And some are very individually attuned to kids, some are not. I remember I lived in Belgium and we were going to a Club Med, and they have in Belgium, at least in our neighborhood, they had something called a creche where the kids would go in the day, young kids. And I asked the lady at Club Med, she said, "Oh, we have a creche so you can relax while you're on vacation." And I said, "Oh, is it like the creche here?" And she said, "Oh, no, we do stuff with the kids," I thought. But I guess on average, the studies suggest that on average, and this is not a strong effect, but that kids who spend a lot of time in daycare tend on average to be slightly more aggressive than those that don't. And so I think that's the research as I understand it. But it's not. I wouldn't say it's a tremendously strong effect and would not be on the top of my list of social concerns. As for the touching, I've spent a fair bit of time in early childhood educations, the good ones, and to be honest, I'm not sure what the rules are, but the parents touch the kids. I mean, the teachers touch the kids, and as they should. But the main thing they do at the really good ones is they just talk at them. They're just, the flow of words is incredible. One of the differences in our society is between middle-class kids who hear on average 480 words per hour and lower-class kids who hear on average 170 words per hour. And so that's over the course of a childhood, that's about 32 million words. And that has an effect. And so if you go to the really good early childhood programs, the teachers are just talking to try to compensate for that. And that's one of the important things they do.
So does that mean all issues of class and race and power have to be leveled in order for a lot of these social policies that we're talking about to be effective ultimately?
Yeah, well, one of the things I think we need to acknowledge is that we do have a vastly unequal society. There's a woman named Annette Leroux who I highly recommend a great book called Unequal Childhoods, and she says, we do not have a continuum of child rearing. We have two entirely different systems. What I grew up with in Radnor is what she calls concerted cultivation, where the kids are driven around and prepared for adulthood. The other is what she, I forget the name she uses, but basically the attitude is life is hard, let the kids relax while they're kids. And in some sense, this is a more sane and healthy way to raise kids, but it doesn't prepare the kids as well for the world we now have as adults. And so we've got to frankly acknowledge that. And then at the most disorganized homes, we have kids who are just not getting those organized attachments. And we have to have schools, and I'm a big supporter of these KIPP academies, which are around, some of these no-excuses schools, where you go into the school, and they teach the kids how to walk down the hallway. They teach them how to look at the eye and nod when somebody's talking to them. They teach them how to say yes, excuse me, thank you, to smile. In the morning, they have these drums, and they have chants, and the teachers chant out what is earned, and the kids have to chant back, everything is earned. So they learn discipline and order and rigor, a lot of the stuff that, frankly, middle-class kids get naturally. These schools have to teach them. And I think they work phenomenally well because they are explicitly based on this marshmallow-type experiment and say, we're going to give those kids those kind of social skills. But you have to acknowledge that we have an unequal society. And we've got to have two different sorts of systems for kids who have certain advantages and some who lack them.
Another question. About five rows back, lady with her hand up.
Has your awareness of this new humanism changed your political philosophies at all?
I just cry a lot more. I think it has. You know, I guess I'd put it this way. We've been through two sort of individualistic revolutions in our lifetimes. In the 60s, we're on the left wing, which was socially liberating the individual. Be free to be you and me, find your own truth, express yourself. And then in the 80s, a more economic individualism, entrepreneurialism, free market, Reagan, one on the left, one on the right. So we've had two revolutions that have emphasized the individual. And I think one of this research does, it emphasizes the community. It emphasizes citizenship, and it emphasizes the relationship between people. And so I'm much more, I think, community-oriented. What can we do to strengthen communities than maybe I used to be? I wrote a book a couple of years ago about the fast-growing suburbs out in the far reaches of the suburbs. I'm now much more suspicious of them because the evidence about density suggests that face-to-face contact really is more innovative and more productive, and cities really have some advantages. And so there's a lot of areas like that where I guess I have changed my mind. And I guess I see everything now psychologically first. And so when I look at Egypt and Tunisia, I see an emotional contagion sweeping across a region. And I see the quest for dignity in the book. I mention a Greek virtue, the thymotic urge, the desire for recognition and dignity. And that's when you appreciate how fundamental a drive that is, then what happened in Cairo doesn't really surprise you as much. So it's influenced me in all those ways. It hasn't made me like, be closer to, Frank Rizzo or Rick Santorum or, anybody like that. But it has had an influence on how I think.
About Tim Roseback, gentleman in the green.
David, I believe Rokesh has said the most important decisions we make in our lives are made from our values. And I'm wondering how that fits in with your book. And a follow-up on your earlier point, we're becoming more divergent politically. How do you see us solving the most significant problems facing us as a country with this divergence politically?
Right.
Thank you.
Well, those are two big questions. First, on the values, I mentioned the importance of unconscious processes. Some of the things that influence our unconscious have to do with early childhood, but some of it have to do with things thousands of years ago, genetic biases, and some of them have to do with things that happened hundreds of years ago, which are cultural biases. And we inherit through our culture, whether it's from the region we live in or from our ethnicity, we inherit certain ways of seeing the world. And so, for example, there's been a lot of research done on how Chinese and Americans look at the world. And one of the experiments, they looked at the Mona Lisa. And the Chinese eyes, they measured the eye movements, were dancing all over the painting. And the American eyes were basically focusing on the eyes and the mouth of the lady, much more concentrated. And another famous experiment was they asked Chinese people to describe a fish tank, and they would describe the relationship between the fish, the plant life, the whole context. The Americans would just pick out the biggest fish and describe that. Another example is they did research. They looked at people having coffee, and they looked at how much they touched each other. And if I get the numbers right, I'll probably get them slightly off. But in Rio, there were about 170 touches an hour as people had coffee. In Paris, I think it was about 120. In London, it was zero. These are values we share not only in these things, but how we perceive justice. Some of our moral intuitions are universal. You don't need to tell any two-year-old anywhere in the world what fairness is. We are born with a sense of fairness. We're born with a sense of pollution. We're born with a deference to authority, certain attitudes towards authority. But within those value systems, whether you're Jewish or Catholic or Protestant or Muslim, whether you're American or French, you come in with all different categories, and you have to be aware of the negotiations of those things. But values can change over time. And so it's all a very complicated stew, but those things are basically fundamental. And when I look at why a country does well or why it doesn't, I think it's fundamentally a values thing. It's not natural resources. It's do you have – these are two really crucial values. Do you believe the future can be different than the present, and do you believe you can control your future? These are not universal. Some places they have it, some places they don't. The U.S., we have exaggerated sense of how much control we have, but it's good for us to have that. Then finally, on the polarization, just tying it into the theme, our brains register in-group and out-group very powerfully. So if I see somebody in my group punished, my brain really reacts violently to that. If I see somebody in an out-group, not my group, being punished, I'm sort of callous about that. And so we have an essentially tribal nature. In Washington, we have tribalism on stilts. We have magnified tribalism. I mentioned the effective groups where people took turns and communicated very well. Well, if you want the dictionary definition of a dysfunctional group, That would be the U.S. Congress. And they don't communicate very well. They don't talk to each other. They don't really listen to each other. And so the polarization that occurs in Washington is in part caused by the fundraising, in part caused by the media redistricting, but it's mostly caused by the psychological psychodynamics of tribalism, I think, and people, good people stuck in this tribal Hatfield and McCoy system. And so I see it primarily as a psychological and moral problem, less a fundraising problem.
Are you saying we just need one political party?
Well, we need parties that actually have conversations with each other.
Oh, let's see. Back here, lady with her hand up on our right.
In your column last Sunday, you spoke about how we Americans overestimate our capabilities in every field. And I'm wondering if that is an unhealthy thing and unrealistic. And how would you compare that to the opposite, which is the tiger mom?
Well, I told this to a group earlier tonight, but I'm going to repeat it. A couple of months ago, I was driving, listening to NPR, and I happened to hear a show called Command Performance, which was a rebroadcast of an old radio show. And the episode I heard was aired on VJ Day, the day we won World War II. And Bing Crosby was the host of the show, and all the big stars were on it, Bob Hope and Marlene Dietrich. He got out there and he said, "We've just learned we won World War II, but I guess we're not proud. We just feel humble. We're just glad we got through it." And Burgess Meredith got out there and read a passage from Ernie Pyle, the great war correspondent. And Pyle wrote, "We won this war because we have brave soldiers. We have great allies. We happen to have a lot of material abundance in this country. We didn't win it because we're God's chosen people. We didn't win it because we're anything special. We should just be glad and be worthy of the peace." And that tone of humility was so striking to me on the day they won World War II. Then I get home and I turn on TV, I'm watching football, and a cornerback tackles a wide receiver after a two-yard gain and does this victory dance to himself for his great achievement. And it occurred to me, I had just seen greater self-puffery after a two-yard gain than winning World War II. And I do think this is a change from a culture of self-effacement, nobody's better than me, I'm no better than anybody else, to a culture of self-celebration. Look at me, I'm pretty damn good. And the polling data used to support this is my favorite one, is that Gallup asked high school seniors in 1950, "Are you a very important person?" And 12% said yes. In 2005, they asked again, "Are you a very important person?" And it wasn't 12%, it was 80%. And so that's just the change. And if you look at our math scores, we're 36th in the world in math performance, but we're number one in the world in thinking we're really good at math. And so that's a change. And this expansion of the self, I think, has led to partisanship, because I know the answers to everything and everybody else who disagrees with me is just in the way. I think it's led to the expansion of debt, because why should I say for future generations I'm here? I feel less connected to the broad change. And I think if you look at the societies that have done really well in math, they're the ones who have least confidence in their own abilities. And so I think the lesson from the research is that you should have a slightly above average view of yourself. You should exaggerate your virtues a little to make sure you go out and dare and try difficult things that are hard for you. But we've sort of taken it a bit to the extreme. And one of the phrases that I think is the core of my political philosophy is the phrase epistemological modesty. Epistemology is the study of what you know. Modesty is modesty. And we should all be aware of how little we know about ourselves, how little we know about the world, and we should prepare ourselves for those weaknesses at all times and not think that we're the bee's knees.
Again, in the center, gentleman with his hand up.
I should say, if you want a good recipe for modesty, write a column twice a week. Because you'll read in the paper, you'll think, "Oh, God, what was I thinking?" What did I...
I've got a quick question for you. I believe it's the question on everybody's mind. What do you believe that can you name three things our current president has done correctly and a dozen things, 20 things that he has not?
I'll ask you to limit that to three and three.
Let's see. Three things he's done correctly. One, he's the best education president we've had since I've been covering education. Two, I disagreed with it at the time, but he was right to rescue GM. I could list more, actually. There are some things I disagreed with, but I do think, and I cover the president, I speak to him periodically. I certainly speak to people on the staff almost every day or several times a week. And I would say within the White House, I disagree with him. I'm to his right. But within the White House, there genuinely is a culture of debate. They do try to find the right answers. They genuinely, you know, have the best interests of the country at heart. They're very smart people there. They half of them come from Harvard, half from Yale. If we're attacked during the Harvard-Yale game, we're screwed because they'll all be up there watching the game. I think there's a generally an honest intellectual culture. As for the failures, I thought when we did health care, I thought we had two central tasks. The first was to cover 39 million uninsured people, and the second was to get our cost inflation under control. We did one. I don't think we did the second. So that would be one thing I disagree with. I think he tried too much in the first few years and really polarized the country maybe more than it needed to be. I wish he would call some of the members of the opposing parties. Someone I'm friendly with is a guy named Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, a very smart chairman of the House Budget Committee. They would really, I know them both men, they would really get along. They'd have wonderful conversations about the future budget, which could really lay the groundwork for some compromises. But Obama has never called Ryan and asked him over to the White House. He's never had a conversation with him. And I just think they should at least talk. And so that's just the function of the nature of Washington, which I think he's very well equipped to change but hasn't really taken the measures. I could go on, but I think that's enough.
Let's see. There's a lady about four rows from the back in the center. You know what, sir? We've got other people with their hands up. Further back.
You spoke about how some variables of success are based on the 18-month-old time period. In an effort to close the achievement gap, the educational achievement gap, would you be a proponent of mandatory early childhood education?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to make it mandatory just because that gives you all sorts of political problems. And I still essentially think that the relationship between a parent and a child is better than is going to happen at a public especially a state-supplied daycare center. So I wouldn't want to force people to do it. Nonetheless, I do think there should be, on the one hand, much more funding for early childhood education. It should be a rite of passage. We should do a lot better job of organizing our early childhood centers, our Head Start centers, so the people there are actually teachers rather than just people we needed to give a job to. And we should start earlier. We should start with nurse-family partnerships and visits, so nurses are coming into homes and giving mom help on how to coach. In the first year of life, the average mother loses 700 hours of sleep, gets interrupted every 20 seconds on average, and sees a decline in marital satisfaction of 70%. It's tough. Little babies are charming, but they're invading your brain, and it's a brutal thing. And so people need help. And if you go to certain neighborhoods, things I've seen are babies locked into a car seat 8 hours a day in front of the TV, Coca-Cola in the bottle just to keep them quiet. There are things where people need help, and we should just be more aggressive. And then you can't stop, because even if you help kids at an early age, a lot of the help fades out, a lot of the benefits. So it has to be like nutrition every day. You got to have early childhood education. You got to have schools where teachers are able to connect with kids. You've got to have mentoring programs. They've got to go to college where they feel emotionally engaged with someone. So if they think about dropping out, there's someone they care about that they have to tell, "I'm dropping out." And so they're sort of engaged with the campuses. All through life, there has to be these concentrations of really relationships. And so I would spend a lot more money on that, and I'm afraid in our budget straits, the fact is the lobbies with the big guns are the K-12 lobby, the college, the higher ed lobby, and mostly the senior citizen lobby. And the zero through three lobby is a pretty pathetic lobby. And so I'm afraid that's very vulnerable in state after state.
Maybe to end the evening, you could take us out with your predictions for 2012, since we're probably not going to see you before then.
I could write another book, but it would kill me. I really wouldn't bet against President Obama. He is a very... He has an amazing ability, and I've seen him a few times since he lost the last election, or the Democrats did, an amazing ability to self-correct. He's a very complicated person with many different personalities, and the downside of that is he rarely commits all out. He's always one step back observing. The upside of that is he tends to look at himself and say, well, how do I need to change? What do I need to do? And so he does have the ability to adjust, and he just has political skills. When I look at politicians, it's like a scout looking at pitchers, who has the best stuff. And I remember when I saw him in 2005, a long time ago, I thought he has the best stuff. He's probably going to be president someday, and I wrote a column in 2006 on him called Run, Barack, Run, urging to run, because I thought he had the best stuff. And so I still wouldn't bet against him. That said, I'm not quite sure what he's going to run on. I don't think he can run the sort of campaign he ran last time, the big transformational hope and change thing. Can't do that anymore after at least 4 years. Can't run on health care, can't run the stimulus package, and his administration has been slow to come up with a new big agenda for what to do in the next 4 years in a country that is still furiously concerned about national decline and furious at government for screwing things up. So that'll be a big challenge. On the Republican side, the person I would like to see get the nomination, I've sort of been upfront about this, I'm not supposed to root for one candidate or another, but it's the governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels. I like him because he's 5'6", low to the ground, in touch with the people. I think you got to be low down there to see things. I think he's been an extremely effective governor. At a time when state budgets have ballooned and debt on average has gone up 40%, state after state, in Indiana, the debt has gone down 40%. At the same time, a lot of the programs that really matter have been improved. Even wait times at the Department of Motor Vehicles have dropped from 60 minutes to 8 minutes. I'm sort of impressed by that. And so I think he's been a very effective government. I think the governor, the Republicans, would do well to counter-program against this graceful and elegant and brilliant Democrat with a guy who may not be charismatic but just knows how to run things. And so I like Daniels. I think the other two serious candidates are Mitt Romney and Tim Pawlenty. Again, managers, I'm a little less enamored with them, I guess. I haven't seen – Pawlenty was a good governor, but I haven't seen quite the really excellence of management that I saw with Daniels. And they would be fine. I guess I would like to see – I think the Republicans have two problems. The first is they, to their credit, and this is to Obama's deficit – they are saying we have to tackle entitlements. And that is a courageous step because the country wants more government than it's willing to pay for. And somebody has to call them on that. And being willing to tackle entitlements is the right thing to do and say we have to adjust some of these benefit levels. A, they politically don't know how to sell it. And B, I don't think the Republicans quite understand is not only do we have a recession, we have structural problems in our economy which have hurt the middle class decade upon decade. And I don't think there's a Republican answer to that problem. And so I think they face some challenges, and they face sort of a talent deficit. So I wouldn't bet against Obama, but it'll be we'll eventually get to have the fight, which we need to have, is here's the money, here's the national wealth, here are our programs, here's our debt, how are we going to figure this thing out? And I'd love to think we're going to have that, that really serious debate, and then to end on a pessimistic note, I really don't think we're going to have that today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.